Well, I'm going to go ahead and mute everybody so that we can have a quiet call, and we will get started. Okay, collector is a real party in interest, the owner of the debt. Chapter 3 examines situations in which the entity collecting the debt does not have authority to use the state's courts. Now, isn't that an interesting first sentence? Does not have authority to use the state's courts, such as when the entity is not properly licensed to collect on a debt or has not properly registered with the state as an out-of-state corporation. This section examines whether the entity suing on the debt has standing to bring the action. Is it the real party in interest? There are at least five different scenarios where a collector is bringing a lawsuit. The collector is the originating creditor and has never assigned the account, even to a securitization trust. Number two, the collector is a bank or other entity that is usually an originating creditor, but in this case is not the originating creditor and instead has merged with or purchased the originating creditor or its portfolio of loans. And we run into that situation a lot out here because of bank mergers and stuff. Number three, the collector is the originating creditor, but has sold the receivables to a securitization trust and is either servicing the account or purchased the receivables back pursuant to a recourse agreement. Number four, the collector is a debt collection agency that has been assigned the debt solely for collection purposes, and the agency is not the real owner of the debt. Number five, the collector is a debt buyer who either purchased the debt from the originating creditor or from some other debt buyer. Okay, where a bank or other creditor is the plaintiff. In general, now we're speaking, even when a collection action is brought by a bank or other creditor, issues of real party and interest and proving ownership often arise. The first step is to determine if the entity suing on the debt has the exact same name as the entity that originated the credit. Now, we've mentioned that many times on Jesse's calls on Tuesday night. You have to look very, very carefully at the names of these companies. It could be Discover Financial Services versus Discover Bank, things like that. So you have to be very meticulous. Often this is not the case. Increasingly today, the entity collecting the debt has merged with or purchased the lender who originally extended the credit, purchased the originating creditor's loan portfolio, or has simply changed its name. For an example, on January 1, 2006, MBNA Corporation merged with and into Bank of America, with MBNA America Bank becoming a subsidiary of Bank of America. Many of you have heard that. You know, you had an MBA card, MBNA card years back, and then all of a sudden you're dealing with Bank of America. That's why there was a merger January 1st of 06. On June 10, 06, MBNA changed its name to FIA Card Services. When an action is brought in the name of FIA Card Services, the collector must provide admissible evidence that FIA Card Services has the right to sue on a debt with MBNA. Okay, I'm going to give you a case here. FIA Card Services versus Thompson, T-H-O-M-P-S-O-N. It's New York District Court from 2008. And it says here, case dismissed when MBNA obtained arbitration award but sought confirmation under the name FIA Card Services. Yeah. They use two different names. Oh, well, we're one and the same. Well, Are you really? Prove it. When an action is brought in the name of FIA Card Services, the collector must provide admissible evidence that FIA Card Services has the right to sue on a debt with MBNA. Similarly, a case has failed where the collector never proved how a household bank account became a Bank of America account. Now, that's interesting. There's a case citation for that. Norfolk, N-O-R-F-O-L-K, Finance Corp. versus Mazard, M-A-Z-A-R-D, Massachusetts District Court, November 12th of 2009. Similar problems may arise where a bank ceased to collect on a Providian credit card account where Providian was sold to Washington Mutual, which then ceased to exist. Okay, we've got a case for that also. Wirth, W-I-R-T-H, versus Cash, C-A-C-H, L-L-C. This is a Georgia Court of Appeals from 2009. Similarly, Bank One accounts are now being collected by Chase Bank. And if any of you happen to be familiar with that, now I'm just drawing a blank. First USA credit cards were acquired by Bank One, who was then acquired by Chase. I happen to have had two of those in the past, and I had a debt collector, Asset Acceptance, call me recently trying to collect on my first on a First USA until they found out they had the wrong person, and they didn't give me any disclosure. I don't need to tell you there's a lawsuit in the offing there. In proving the transfer of accounts from one bank to another, the records must meet all evidentiary standards. An appellate court had little trouble rejecting a collector's evidence of J.P. Morgan's purchase of credit card portfolios from other banks by reference to a New York Times article and to Wikipedia. Now, isn't that interesting? There's a case citation here. Palisades Collection, LLC, versus Grabard, spelled G-R-A-U-B-A-R-D, New Jersey Superior Court Appellate Division, April of 2009. Thus, the collector failed to prove that First USC, a division of Bank One, purchased the credit card operations of Chevy Chase Bank, and that Bank One was purchased by J.P. Morgan and Company. Other confusion is created where the originating creditor brings a collection action but uses the name of a different subsidiary than the entity that originated the loan. Thus, a court questioned the standing of American Express travel-related services company to bring a collection action where the monthly statements were sent by American Express, and the agreement was with American Express Centurion Bank. Oh, you know, I have that situation. I had cards with American Express travel-related services. Same scenario. There is a case there, American Express Travel Related Services Company versus ASSI, spelled A-S-S-I-H. And it's New York Civil Court, December of 2009. If American Express is an assumed name, the company must comply with any applicable state law requiring corporations to file a certificate of doing business under an assumed name. And that, there's a case citation here. Miller versus Wolpoff, spelled W-O-L-P-O-F-F, and Abramson, A-B-R-A-M-S-O-N, Northern District of Indiana, September of 2007. It's affirmed by the Federal Court, Seventh Circuit, in 2009. I've used Miller versus Wolpoff before. Even where a credit card issuer brings a collection action in its own exact name, questions can still arise as to whether the obligation was sold to a securitization trust, and what that implies for the card issuer still remaining the real party in interest. That topic is briefly discussed right here. We're going to touch on that right now, and this is something I've been doing some work on. Securitization of credit card obligations, and listen closely here because there's a little bit of work that you'd have to do with this, but it can be very, very good in defending against a credit card suit. It is common knowledge for a credit card issuer to securitize its credit card receivables. For example, apparently all Citibank credit card accounts are securitized. There are a number of complex ways in which this is accomplished. To further complicate matters, a credit card securitization is different in many ways than a mortgage loan securitization. To oversimplify, a card issuer will sell the right to receivables from a portfolio of credit card accounts. After changing hands a number of times, ownership of those receivables will reside in a trust that can issue securities in the assets held by the trust. The card issuer continues to own the account, less the right to the receivables, and thus remains the party with the contractual relationship with the cardholder, and the card issuer services the account. There's a case citation here. Tostado, spelled T-O-S-T-A-D-O, versus Citibank. And that is from the Western District of Texas, January of 2010. Thus, the card issuer can change interest rates and amend the contract. And it also receives payments and collects from the consumer where there is a delinquency. The trust owns the receivables on the card accounts, the right to payments. Since the amount owed and paid on a credit card account changes every month, the receivables held by the trust are constantly fluctuating. The rights of the card issuer and the trust typically are spelled out in a pooling and servicing agreement, commonly known as a PSA. The PSA may provide that upon the occurrence of default, as defined in that agreement, the receivable is either automatically transferred back to the card issuer, or the trust has the right to transfer the receivable back at its election. The PSA may also delegate to the card issuer on behalf of the trust the right to bring a lawsuit in its own name to collect delinquent accounts. Now, I'm going to make a quick comment here because I've been doing some stuff. I have found the securitization stuff for Bank of America. And the pooling and servicing agreement is right there. It's several hundred pages, but the receivables are transferred from FIA Card Services to another entity before it goes to the trust. And And if you do a little bit of looking out there, you can find this stuff. This means that when a credit card issuer is collecting on a debt in its own name, any one of a number of different scenarios could be at play. And this is really critical to pay attention to here, because this can make or break you if you do your research. The card issuer may have never securitized the loan, and there will be little question as to its right to bring a collection action in its own name. The card issuer instead may be suing in its own name as a servicer for the trust. Okay, and I've got a case citation for that. CAPS, spelled CAPPS, versus FIA Card Services. And that is a Idaho decision from 2010. The trustee is the real party in interest, and the servicer's right to bring the action in its own name instead will be determined by state law. Faced with a challenge as to the servicer's right to bring the action, the servicer will have to identify the owner of the receivables, the trust, and produce evidence that it has been delegated the right to bring the action on behalf of the trust. Usually that evidence will be found in the PSA, the Pooling and Servicing Agreement. Now, most of us have never thought about all the stuff with securitization except with mortgages. It's a whole deal going on with the credit cards too, everybody. That's how they turn this stuff around and generate cash. Without this evidence, the servicer has no right to proceed. Even with this evidence, some states place additional restrictions on a servicer's right to do so. For example, Pennsylvania rules of procedure require that a plaintiff acting in a fiduciary or representative capacity disclose the capacity in the caption and in the plaintiff's initial pleading. In the caption means up at the top in the court styling as to who is suing who. Alternatively, the card issuer may be suing after the rights to the receivables on the account have been transferred back to the card issuer from the trust. Then, for the card issuer to bring an action, it will have to prove that assignment from the trust back to the card issuer. Amazing. Where the PSA provides that the transfer back to the card issuer is automatic on the occurrence of certain events, it is unclear whether proof of this provision in the PSA will be enough, or whether the card issuer must also produce a written transfer back to the card issuer. I've got a case citation on that, which is Citibank versus Carroll, C-A-R-R-O-L-L. And that case is out of Idaho, 2009. And the caption here on this, originating card issuer has standing to sue, although court did not consider whether there must be a separate document evidencing the assignment back to the creditor. If the PSA alone is deemed sufficient, then the card issuer will have to show that the events specified in the PSA as triggering the transfer have occurred. In other words, they've got to produce documents saying these various things have occurred. They can't. A lawyer can't just come in and testify in court. Doesn't work that way. Another scenario is where the card issuer claims that it can bring the action, not as the servicer or the owner of the right to receivables, but based upon its remaining interest in the account after the right to receivables have been transferred to the trust. While at least one court has apparently accepted this basis to bring an action, and that case is Tostado, T-O-S-T-A-D-O, versus Citibank. This is one I mentioned a little bit ago, versus Citibank, Western District of Texas, January of 2010. This is open to question, since two different entities cannot both have the right to the same receivable. The consumer should not have to pay the amount owed twice. In an odd twist, if there is no proof of a valid transfer of receivables from the card issuer to the trust, then the court may treat the case as properly brought by the card issuer because there is not proof that the issuer ever relinquished the right to payment. Thus, in order to dispute a card issuer's right to bring suit, the consumer must first prove that the right to receivables has been sold to a trust. Now listen to the next sentence. This can be most effectively done by sending the card issuer a request to admit this fact. In your admissions, you add that question. Again, this can be most effectively done by sending the card issuer a request to admit this fact. If the consumer introduces the PSA instead, the consumer will have then introduced the very evidence that the card issuer can use to help show its right to bring the action. In other words, don't do it. The exact structure of a particular securitization can be both complex and unique, and there is little case law as to the right of a card issuer to bring a collection action after an account has been involved in a securitization. Suffice it to say that it may be difficult to unravel the rights of the parties, and consumer attorneys may soon feel out of their depth. On the other hand, the collection attorney may not want to devote the resources to investigating and explaining to the court how the securitization works in the case of an individual consumer and why the card issuer has the right to pursue the case in its own name. It may be that a collection attorney facing consumer discovery or legal challenges concerning the securitization will opt to dismiss the case. I can imagine why they do that. Okay, collection agency's ability to bring action in their own name on behalf of another. It is important to distinguish between a case brought by a debt buyer to collect a debt it claims to own, and that brought by a debt collection agency suing on behalf of another, such as the originating creditor. In that latter case, the debt collection agency does not own the debt and will turn over at least a portion of what it collects on the debt to the account's owner. Whether the action is brought on behalf of another or by a debt buyer in its own right, there must be a written assignment to the plaintiff giving it the right to sue on the debt. I'm going to read that again. Whether the action is brought on behalf of another or by a debt buyer in its own right, there must be a written assignment to the plaintiff giving it the right to sue on the debt. When challenged, the collector must produce such a written assignment. An affidavit stating there is such an assignment is not sufficient. I'll bet you want a case citation. Unifund, CCR Partners versus Shah, spelled S-H-A-H. and that's Illinois Appeals Court, February of 2011. And, of course, there must be proof that the entity that is assigning those rights has the right to pursue the collection action. Additional requirements apply where a collection agency is suing on behalf of another. Where an entity is in the business of collecting debts for another, there can be little question that the entity is covered by the state debt collection statute. In that case, the state debt collection statute may place various limits on a debt collector collecting on the debt. It may prohibit outright the collection agency from bringing legal actions to collect on the debt of another. It may prohibit an unlicensed collection agency from bringing suit. Okay, there was a note down here, and that's not something I'm going to read. In other states, the debt collector will have to disclose in the pleadings on whose behalf it is suing. For example, Pennsylvania rules of procedure require that a plaintiff acting in a fiduciary or representative capacity disclose the capacity in the caption and in the plaintiff's initial pleading. And that's right in the Pennsylvania Rules of Civil Procedure 2002(b). Typically, the collector's authority to sue on behalf of another is based upon a written assignment, and state debt collection statutes may specify the nature of that assignment from the debt owner to the collection agency. In Ohio, for example, there must be a writing authorizing the collection agency to refer the matter to an attorney. The writing must specify the consideration to be received by the collection agency. The matter can only be brought in the county where the consumer resides, and the matter must be brought by an attorney admitted to practice in the state. And I've got a case citation for you there. Recovery Management Systems Limited, LTD, versus Coburn, spelled C-O-B-U-R-N. This is a Ohio Court of Appeals, November 2008. Florida has a requirement that the consumer be notified within 30 days of when a debt is assigned to another. There's a lot of people that don't know about that. Florida statute, I'm going to read this slowly, and this is telling you exactly the law in Florida that says they got to notify you. Florida statute, section 559.715. Again, that's Florida statute, section 559.715. And this would seem to apply to an assignment for collection purposes only. Because these requirements may apply only to a debt collector suing on behalf of another and not to a debt buyer, it is important to carefully read the assignment document to determine the exact relationship between assignor and assignee. Is the assignment transferring ownership or only the right to sue on the debt for another? Always read these documents and see exactly what they say. It's very important. The need to review the assignment document is another reason why the collector must produce the actual assignment and not an affidavit stating that the debt has been assigned, particularly where the affidavit is vague as to whether the assignment is for collection purposes only. An internet search or contacting the state debt collection licensing agency can also provide some rough indication of whether the collector is primarily in the business of purchasing debts or collecting debts on behalf of creditors. Okay, let's go to debt buyer's proof of ownership of the debt. Ownership is a precondition to a collection suit. Obviously, if they don't own a debt, they do not have standing to make a claim, bring a suit on it. A debt buyer seeking to sue on a debt it alleges it owns has the burden of proof to show that it does own the consumer's obligation. And there's a bunch of case citations, but I'm not going to give you all of them. I'll give you several. There's probably about 15 of them here. That's how complete this book is. Great Seneca Finance Corporation versus Leanna, spelled L-E, capital A-N-N-A. And that's Connecticut Superior Court, August 15th of 2006. Here's one of our favorites, LVNV Funding, LLC, versus Schechter, spelled S-H-E-C-T-E-R. And that's a Florida Palm Beach County court from June of 2009. And that's available at www.consumerlaw.org/unreported. Ray Klein, K-L-E-I-N, Incorporated, versus Kerr, K-E-R-R. That's a Missouri Court of Appeals, 2008. There's Midwestern Health Management Inc. versus Walker, W-A-L-K-E-R. Missouri Court of Appeals, 2006. And I'll give you one more here. New Century Financial Services. Versus Sanchez, S-A-N-C-H-E-Z. And that's a New Jersey Superior Court Law Division, April of 2002. And that also is available at consumerlaw.org/unreported. Okay, a consumer defendant should always put the debt buyer to its proof that it owns the debt. Debt buyers often cannot meet this burden. We already know that. The consumer should not have to pay a debt to one party only to find out later that another party is the true owner and that the consumer must now pay the same debt again to the second party. And believe it or not, case citation, which is Miller versus Wolpoff and Abramson, what I gave you just a little bit ago. And that is Northern District of Indiana, September of 2007. The difficulty of the collector's proof that it owns the debt and the risk that more than one debt buyer will seek payment from the consumer on the same debt both increase as the debt is transferred from debt buyer to debt buyer. In one case, the successor company to Providian assigned a debt to Vision Management Services. which then assigned it 3 days later to Great Seneca Financial Corporation, which a month later assigned it to Account Management Services. 4 months later, Account Management Services, which shortly thereafter changed its name, assigned the account to Madison Street Investments, which then assigned the account 5 months later to Jackson Capital, which on that same day assigned the account to Centurion Capital. 3 weeks later, Centurion hired Wolpoff and Abramson as their attorneys to collect on the debt. After the transfer to Jackson Capital, but before the transfer to Centurion Capital, the consumer was sued on the account by Melville Acquisitions Group, which appears nowhere in the above chain of ownership. Debt buyers purchase large portfolios of accounts from creditors and then subdivide the portfolios into smaller segments and sell off those segments to different debt buyers. The same segment of a portfolio may be sold to multiple buyers, or the seller may not actually own a portfolio put up for sale. Gee, what a concept. Sell something you don't own. Couple case citations. This one's available at consumerlaw.org unreported. United States versus Goldberg, Goldberg, and that is the Southern District of Florida, March 5th of 2009. And the note here is debt buyer obtained accounts without paying for them and then resold them, even though original seller had voided sale because of non-payment. Jeez. Okay, another one. Wood versus M&J Recovery, LLC. And that is Eastern District of New York, April of 07. And that one, at least three different entities claim ownership of a consumer debt. Boy. Just amazing. For example, debt buyers may purchase accounts with the debt buyer's payment to the assigner due in the future, and the assigner may take back the account if the debt buyer fails to make payments when due. But there is little to prevent the defaulting debt buyer from selling the accounts to another debt buyer, even though the original assigner takes back the same accounts. And you can find information on that again in the United States versus Goldberg, the one that I just mentioned. You can reference that. The sale to the debt buyer may be evidenced by no more than a computer tape that can be easily duplicated and sold without the authority to do so. Good security of the information, isn't it, wouldn't you say? Debt buyer's business model is to purchase debt for pennies on the dollar and then seek payments with a minimal investment of effort. The debt buyer is unlikely to put much effort into establishing proper documentation of an assignment when it is suing the consumer on one relatively small debt, and if challenged by the consumer, will often have difficulty meeting its burden of proving that it owns the debt. Okay, adequate proof of transfer of ownership to a debt buyer. Let's talk about that. A debt buyer must prove that it has been assigned an account through tender of proper documentation specifically related to the particular account at issue. Okay, case citation on that is one I've given you, New Century Financial Services versus Sanchez, and that's available at consumerlaw.org. And there is Citibank versus Martin, and that's New York Civil Court, 2005. There's also Palisades Collections, LLC, versus Gonzalez. And that's a New York Civil Court, December of 05. It is insufficient to introduce a notice from the assignor to the consumer that it is assigning the debt to the assignee. Again, it is insufficient to introduce a notice from the assignor to the consumer that it is assigning the debt to the assignee. There is one case citation, which is Wright, W-R-I-G-H-T, versus Asset Acceptance Corporation. And that's from the Southern District of Ohio, January of 2000. The actual assignment document should be introduced into evidence. A memorandum or other statement from the debt buyer stating that it has received assignment of the account at issue is also insufficient. And that one, case citation, that goes to the New Century Financial versus Sanchez again, which is available at consumerlaw.org. Mere affirmation of the assignment in an affidavit is also insufficient. The debt buyer must submit actual contracts of assignment identifying the accounts at issue. You can't just have them stick, and one of their favorite tricks is to just put a copy of a supposed sale agreement in there with names and stuff redacted and no individual account listings. If it doesn't specifically list that account and other pertinent information like your social and or name, that's not sufficient. And we've got several case citations there. One that I've already given here, LVNV Funding, LLC, versus Schechter, S-H-E-C-T-E-R, and that is available at consumerlaw.org/unreported. There's also Palisades Collection, LLC, versus Thomas, T-H-O-M-A-S. That's Broward County, Florida, court, April of 2009. And that's also available at consumerlaw.org. All right. A memorandum, mere affirmation of the assignment in an affidavit is also insufficient. The debt buyer must submit actual contracts of assignment identifying the accounts at issue. None of this, well, yeah, they assigned it to us. No. That doesn't work. The assignment document is a business record that needs authentication through a proper affidavit. That is very, very important. The assignment document is a business record that needs authentication through a proper affidavit. If the debt buyer's employee is the affiant attesting to a document assigning the debt to that collector, the affidavit must meet all the requirements necessary to satisfy the business records exception to the hearsay rule. There can be little question that an employee of a third-party debt buyer in a chain of transfers cannot authenticate a document memorializing the assignment from the first to the second debt buyer in a chain of transfers. And I've got some case citations here. Wright, W-R-I-G-H-T. This is one that I gave you just a little bit ago. Versus Asset Acceptance. Southern District of Ohio, January of 2000. Norfolk, N-O-R-F-O-L-K, Finance Corporation versus Mazard, spelled M-A-Z-A-R-D. It's a 2009 case from November, Massachusetts District Court. And then I'll give you one here that's available on consumerlaw.org. That is Colorado Capital Investments, Inc. versus Villar, V-I-L-L-A-R. And that's a New York civil court case from June of 2009. The collector's employee has no knowledge of nature of that the assignment or those entities' business records. That sounds a little odd. The collector's employee has no knowledge of the nature of the assignment or of those entities' business records. Yeah, there's a typo in the book here. That's why it confused me. Thus, in one case, the debt buyer submitted an affidavit from its agent with a printed copy of several pages from an electronic spreadsheet listing the consumer's account as one of the accounts sold to the debt buyer. The appellate court found this insufficient where the affidavit was not a proper foundation for the spreadsheet as a business record. Case on that is Palisades Collection, LLC, versus KEDIK, spelled K-E-D-I-K. And that is a New York Appeals Division case, 2009. The agent did not establish that he was familiar with the debt buyer's business practices and procedures or establish when, how, or by whom the electronic spreadsheet submitted in paper form was made. Details, details, details. Furthermore, the agent failed to establish that the printed spreadsheet was a true and accurate representation of the electronic record. Debt buyers usually can produce a quite detailed contract or bill of sale delineating the relationship between the debt buyer's assigner and the debt buyer. But the document will make reference only generally to thousands of accounts being purchased at the same time and will not identify the consumer's account. That's what I was just talking about a moment ago. If it doesn't specifically show your account, it's worthless, and you got to challenge it. This evidence is not enough. Each assignment document must indicate that one of the thousands of accounts the collector has purchased is the account at issue in the lawsuit. The debt buyer's documentation of each assignment must reference the specific account at issue. And boy, there's a bunch of citations here. I'll give you a couple, three of them. Kendall. This is in regard to Kendall. Bankruptcy Court, Northern District of Oklahoma, 2007. Another one is Persolve, spelled P-E-R-S-O-L-V-E, versus Uribe, U-R-I-B-E. That's California Superior Court, December of 2010. And that is available at consumerlaw.org/unreported. You also have Velocity Investments versus Bailey, B-A-I-L-E-Y. It's a Connecticut Superior Court, June 2007 case. And I'll give you one more here. Unifund, CCR Partners versus Riley, spelled R-I-L-E-Y. And that is a Michigan Court of Appeals, February of 2010. Debt buyers may seek to rectify this failing by saying that they are attaching to the affidavit or other document the actual computer tape or spreadsheet listing all of the assigned accounts, including the consumer's account. Nevertheless, in a surprising number of cases, the debt buyer will not attach the computer tape or offer any evidence that the particular consumer's account being sued on is on that computer tape. This evidence is not sufficient to prove assignment. I'll give you a couple case citations here. One is Wright. This is one I've already given, but it's W-R-I-G-H-T versus Asset Acceptance Corporation. And that's the Southern District of Ohio, January of 2000. Another one is Bullock, spelled B-U-L-L-O-C-K, versus Worldwide Asset Purchasing, LLC. And I've had dealings with those people. They didn't like me. That is Kentucky Court of Appeals, September of 2008. Other times, an affidavit or documentation will refer to a schedule or appendix that allegedly will identify the account, but no schedule or appendix will be attached. Well, how dumb is that? Give you a couple case citations there. Gigli, spelled G-I-G-L-I, versus Palisades Collection, LLC. This is the Middle District of Pennsylvania, August of 2008. Another one here that's I've mentioned before, Velocity Investments versus Bailey. That's Connecticut Superior Court, June of 2007. Wirth, spelled W-I-R-T-H, versus Cash, C-A-C-H, LLC. And that is a Georgia Court of Appeals, 2009. Similarly, an affidavit cannot refer to an appendix that lists accounts in the plural, but then only attach the consumer's account number and not other accounts. Aha! They need to list them all and show that yours is included with them, obviously. I've got one case citation there, Colorado Capital Investments. This is one that I gave you earlier, but Colorado Capital Investments, Inc. versus Villar, V-I-L-L-A-R, June of 2009, and that is available at consumerlaw.org/unreported. Carefully review all documents of assignment because they are often incomplete or illegible. In one case, the court found an assignment to be improper when the debt buyer submitted only 4 pages of a 20-plus page loan sale agreement. That was pretty interesting. And that is C&W Asset Acquisition LLC versus Somogi. Now, I'm going to spell this one. Somogyi. And that is Missouri Court of Appeals, 2004. The court observed the first page entitled Loan Sale Agreement merely identifies the parties and states the effective date of the transaction. The second page contains a pair of signatures. Third page contains a redacted table of 4 accounts. These 3 pages do not appear to have any relationship to one another, given that they were respectively numbered I, 7, and 19 of 28. Real complete stuff they put in there. In another case, the debt buyer produced a series of exhibits that showed the defendant's name, address, and account number on a blacked-out photocopy that purported to evidence several transfers of the debt. The court found this evidence inadequate without a supporting affidavit. Love those affidavits. And a case citation is Great Seneca Financial Corporation. This is one that I've given you before. Versus Leanna, spelled L-E, capital A-N-N-A. And that's Connecticut Superior Court, August of 06. In another case, the debt buyer's affidavit specified a date of assignment over 3 months after the date specified in the alleged bill of sale. Goodness. Case citation on that is Unifund CCR, assignee of Providian versus Ahan, spelled A-Y-H-A-N. That is a Washington Court of Appeals, August 5th of 2008. Some states may also have statutory requirements which apply to the assignment document. Ohio, for example, has detailed provisions relating to assignments to a collection agency. Florida law requires that an assignee must give a debtor written notice of the assignment within 30 days. We kind of mentioned that before, after the assignment. If the collector cannot produce evidence of this notice, the case should be dismissed. And the case citation for that, for the dismissal, when they haven't notified you of the assignment, is LVNV Funding LLC versus Harris. And that is Florida, Miami-Dade County Court, June of 2009. And that is available at consumerlaw.org/unreported. All right. We're just about an hour. I think I'm going to cut it right there. We can pick up on this next week.